you're 21 or older, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. You can order nicotine pouches online. They ship directly to most states, or check out their store locator to purchase pouches at thousands of retail locations around the country. Black Buffalo Tobacco Alternative, bold flavor, full pouches. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults age 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco. You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without your essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. Man, I was just in Hawaii and I had my Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie with me. And here's the deal. We're in and out of the water all the time, getting in to go spearfishing, getting out, taking the kids to the beach. I'm not going to mess around all day putting sunscreen on, then having to get washed off. I just run a hoodie. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear. Telling you what, Dekt is a game changer. Dekt has completely changed how I load, organize my truck. All my stuff that I want is always in there, out of my way, and secure. It's perfect. If you own a pickup truck that you use, you know, like a truck, the Dekt drawer system gives you weatherproof storage for all your gear. You can lock it up too. You keep your tools and gear organized, job site or out in the field. Go to Dekt.com/meat eater to receive free shipping. Go to Dekt.com/meat eater and get yourself some free shipping.
This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by First Light, creating proven, versatile hunting apparel from merino base layers to technical outerwear for every hunt. First Light, go farther, stay longer. I want to start this show out by saying this. Meat Eater's American History, The Long Hunters, 1761 to 1775, is out now. When you get to the end of this episode, you're going to hear a long, I don't want to call it long, you're going to hear a very good explanation of what this project is and why you want to buy it. Just be prepared for that. Like, when you get to the end of the episode, get your credit card out and go to wherever you buy your audiobooks, because you're going to be like, damn, I'm buying that. So get to the end, and I'm going to tell you a lot about it. I'm going to just convince you just how good it is. It's really good. We've been talking about it a long time. This is narrated by me, Stephen Ranella, and Clay Newcomb from the Bear Grease Podcast. And it is a audio original. It's like an audio book that you listen to, okay? And it's called Meat Eater's American History, The Long Hunters, 1761 to 1775. It tells one of the most bloody, hair-raising stories of hunting in American history. It's out now, but listen to the show, enjoy the show, but know that at the end of the show that you're about to listen to, I'm going to give you the sales pitch to end all sales pitches. So you can, if you're not convinced, you can listen and be convinced, or you can just know that you'll be convinced and buy it now. I don't really care. I just want you to get it and start listening, because this is one of the things that I've made that I'm most proud of. Meat Eater's American History, The Long Hunters, available now and explained in greater detail at the end of the show, so stay tuned. Okay, everybody, I'm very, very excited to announce that I am seated here with the writer and film director, Werner Herzog, who's made over 60 films and documentaries, including many I'm sure you heard of and a bunch of them that you better have seen. Little Dieter Needs to Fly, Rescue Dawn, the famous, in my circle of people, Grizzly Man, Happy People, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which I believe is your only film that I managed to catch when it released in a theater in New York. Cave of Forgotten Dreams. His films deal with extremes, with struggle, with absurdity, with madness, with happiness, and many are fused, in my opinion, with a very unique perspective on nature and the natural world. If you read about Herzog, you'll often find writers describing it his work as man against nature, man versus nature. We'll find out if he describes it that way. I'm guessing he doesn't, as I believe that that description would imply that nature is aware of man as an adversary. Mr. Herzog, a couple of your own quotes. The universe is monstrously indifferent to the presence of man. You also once said, I believe the common denominator of the universe is not harmony, but chaos, hostility, and murder. Now, many documentarians who deal with the natural world, I find personally, seem to reflect the relationship with nature sometimes feels to me as though it's taught, as though it's something they picked up or learned from their peers. It's oftentimes political. But our guest here today, I feel that the things he has to say about the natural world and the way that the natural world plays into his movies is wholly original, influenced me immensely, not just as a writer or a TV person, but as a human. I'd say for me on par with Cormac McCarthy, because both have these immense bodies of work that interplay together as something that is not schizophrenic, meaning they carry this sort of intellectual trademark. And the last little bit of introduction, I'll say, and this is a very inside joke. When I'm arguing with production people, which I do in my line of work, I've a lot of times dealt with camera guys, producers that want to catch the entirety of a process. And if they can't catch the entirety of a process, they don't want to use it. And I will say to them in shorthand, I will take a line from Happy People and I will say, the nets were set the night before, because there's a scene in Happy People which chronicles the lives of Siberian fur trappers and subsistence hunters. And there's a scene that opens where they're just checking a net. And my camera guys would have been like, well, we can't use that. We never saw you set the net. To which I will refer them to Happy People and I will say to them, the nets were set the night before. And that's it. Go on with your movie. Go on with your movie. I want to start our conversation, talk a little bit about your childhood, which I was like I said, my avenue to you and your work has just been your movies. I've been a fan of your movies for such a long time. And it wasn't until I read your new book, which I haven't finished yet, but started your new book. Tell me, it's Every Man for Himself and God Against All. Your life story. Yeah. I didn't realize the extent of the poverty that you grew up in.
Well, it's easy to imagine when you grew up at the end of the Second World War and then mostly post-war time. And you have to imagine a scenario where everybody here in the country, in the United States, is very well aware how Ground Zero looked at 9/11, mm-hmm. after 9/11. Complete devastation, but a very limited area on the island of Manhattan. But you have to imagine a whole country, Germany, where 720 or so cities were wiped out, the entire cities. Some of them not as completely, for example, Munich, where I was born, was only 80-85% flattened and destroyed. And it was one of these Allied bombing raids, carpet bombings, that hit our neighborhood and everything around destroyed. And I was only 2 weeks old, 14 days old. And where we lived was partially destroyed. And my mother picks me up from my cradle, which was covered with about a foot high shards of glass and bricks and debris. But I was unhurt. Mm-hmm. And of course, you get, when you're a mother, you naturally are scared. And she fled with my older brother and me into the remotest mountain valley in the Alps. in Bavaria.
And your dad had split out on you guys? Your dad wasn't in the picture at this time.
He wasn't in the picture. Well, he was in the war.
Yeah.
When I was born. I was born in 1942. The war was over 1945. And when he came back, he very soon divorced. My mother was a single mother and had to raise. Then she had another boy, my younger brother. So she had to raise three children, and there was never enough to eat. So what I remember very well is starving.
Yeah, you tell a story of a lesson you learned about nagging your mother, of you and your brother nagging your mother about how hungry you were, and her saying, if I could take it from my ribs, I would take it from my ribs.
Yeah, but I can't.
But I can't.
And you shut up, boys, and yeah. That was a serious moment, and it's engraved in my memories. So, and of course, it was not only food. We had literally nothing. For example, we didn't have mattresses. My mother stuffed burlap sacks with hay that she made from fern. But when you cut the stem of a fern, it hardens when it dries. It hardens like the tip of a sharp pencil.
Yeah, you're saying
pencil.
She would cut it with a scythe. Yeah.
Yes, she cut it with a scythe. And you would feel it at night when you shifted around. All of a sudden, you were on two pencils that were stinging you. And fern also hardens. It's not like hay, more fluffy. It becomes almost like cement, and you have these little dents. And I had to navigate the dents in my mattress. So my entire childhood, I never had a flat surface on which I slept. And we had no running water. You had to go to the well with a bucket and bring in the water, and no sewage system, no heating. No toilet, but an outhouse, which was adjacent to this little house where we grew up.
And you talk about eating someone killing a crow or a raven.
Yeah, yes, yes.
And you being surprised by the image, the seeing fat.
Yeah,
fat on a soup broth and being surprised by fat.
I never had seen anything like this, and until today, this means wealth. Or, for example, the first time I ate a fried egg or an egg in my life, I must have been about 10 or 11. And it was like an incredible feast. Uh-huh. Never ate a chicken for me when I see. And even, you see, even when you drive by the fast food Kentucky fried chicken, finger licking good. And it makes an impression on me. Because chicken means the definitive feast.
You mentioned another detail of your mother getting a loaf of bread with food coupons, or however you describe them, but then scoring the bread in seven segments
for each day,
so that she would partition the bread as the week's ration of bread.
Yeah,
and in that passage. You mentioned, you don't elaborate on it, and I was looking for you to elaborate on it, that you said that you have no tolerance for the culture of complaint.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I get it, but explain that to me.
Well, I cannot make it the norm how I grew up. It was an unusual childhood because it was... in the aftermath of a catastrophic war that Germany actually had started, and the catastrophe came from our own people, from our society, from our leader Adolf Hitler, and it was really so bad that we knew now what we got, and each one of us had a thin slice of bread per day, and the kind of grooves that my mother carved into the loaf of bread. We knew this was the only thing we have. And of course, she would also make some food from dandelion leaves and from syrup from some trees and replacing sugar, which we didn't have. So when I see in our kind of societies, Western, highly technical societies, where a lot of food is being thrown away. In the United States, I think more than 40% of food, and I find it outrageous, and I never say anything because it was my experience, and I know the value of food. I know there's something which has to be honored, and it, in a way, it pains me when I see so much food being thrown away. Because of my experience, it was unusual. But I never speak out loud. But
you don't chastise people for wasting
No,
food.
For God's sake, I would be the last one. That's not in my nature. Because you have to determine how you live and whether you live a life of consumerism or whether you are more cautious with wasting resources that we have. And I think when you are in other societies, hunters and gatherers, they are more careful and cautious. There's no doubt in my heart, because that's how we were organized as biological creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I say, I see people in the restaurant complaining to the waiter that this wasn't any good and give it back to the kitchen. And so I don't like this complaint. And it's not only about food, it's about whatever. Our lives are so difficult, and gasoline has become so expensive and all these things. Yes, deal with it. Deal with it in the right way, but don't complain too much.
I got two questions stacked up in my head, and one I was going to ask you and one I thought about asking you and decided not to, but now I am going to ask you because you alluded to it.
Yeah.
My father fought in World War II.
Yeah.
Served in the European theater and maintained, we joke about it now, but maintained a deep suspicion of Germany through to the end.
Rightly so.
Zero for Japan. Zero for Japan.
With your father.
Well, yeah. I'm not getting at that, but what was the, it's kind of like outside of a subject matter I'm like anything, but, or that I'm an expert on, but what was the, how did you perceive when you're thrust in at a young age, when you're thrust into such like this devastating situation and so many of your countrymen are being killed, your cities are being destroyed, you're starving. What is your perception of Germany? Is it gone?
No, of course not. I'm still a German citizen.
No, I'm saying people feeling about, you know what I mean? Is this all happening to them? Is it a thing they created? What was your mom's perception, I guess?
There was a different response. Some of them, you still, until today, you have deniers. You even have Holocaust deniers, which is the most absurd of all, because it's hundreds, thousands of times documented. Survivors are there. The bodies were found. A crime of proportions that the world has never seen in any country throughout the entire history of the human race. Nothing like that has ever happened. So, you have to ask yourself, what went wrong? What made Germany lapse into a culture from a very solid culture, philosophy, mathematics, writers, composers, you just name it. How does it lapse into a culture of barbarism within very few years?
Mm-hmm.
So of course that gave me to think, and of course it has importance. Always something is resonating from that in my entire existence.
And but where did the blame, what was your sense of or perhaps this would be a question that you'd have to answer on your mother's behalf. What was the sense of blame? Was the blame the Allies? Was the blame on England,
No.
the U.S. for doing this?
No, or? I think the overwhelming part of the population knew it was self-inflicted. Mm-hmm. And you have to also see one strange thing when you speak about Germany as a child, and even when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I didn't know that Germany existed, that there was such a thing like Germany. For me, this valley in the mountains, that was the world. And beyond that, yes, there was Austria, because the border was closed, and some young men, the bold young men, would secretly smuggle goods from Austria into Germany, and some of them were my childhood heroes. But I did not notice, I had no concept that there were countries, I mean Austria, Tyrol, yes, our valley, and something beyond it. And my very first memory that I have about, must have been 2.5 years, Allied bombers hit the city of Rosenheim. And my mother took us out of bed, and it was in the middle of the night, ice cold, must have been March or April, still snow out there. And very far in the distance, at the end of the valley, you could see the entire sky not burning, not flickering, or so, a very slow pulsing of red and orange. And she said, "Boys, the city of Rosenheim is burning." But the city of Rosenheim is 40 miles away, that far, mm-hmm. an entire city burning. And for me, it was a very essential moment, because I apparently started to understand there's a world out there, not our valley alone, and not the waterfall in the ravine behind the home, that there was something out there that was different and dangerous and burning, and there was such a thing like a war. Of course, we saw American soldiers coming in, but they were very genial with the kids and befriended the kids. And for the first time, I saw an African-American, and I was completely enthralled. A huge, big guy with a big resonant voice, a little bit, I always compare him to Shaquille O'Neal, mm-hmm. a very, very big man with a very big heart and a wonderful voice, a soft, wonderful voice. That was for us, we only knew it from fairy tales, the Moors.
Oh, yeah.
The Moors, and there was a Moor, and I was completely fascinated. And I knew, yes, it's true, there's some foreign countries like Africa, and you have the Moors, and there are Moors in America. How about that?
I want to tell you about an American-made success story and Black Buffalo's award-winning nicotine pouches. Black Buffalo was built by dippers with decades of smokeless tobacco use. Black Buffalo is all about the history and tradition of dip, but they understand the convenience and discretion modern-day consumers are looking for. Black Buffalo's nicotine pouches give you the versatility to consume discreetly, but keep the ritual with flavors dippers love. Mint, straight, and wintergreen, all proudly made right here in the USA. Tell them, Chili.
The reason I like Black Buffalo pouches is, one, they're very discreet. And what I mean by that is I can throw one in and almost forget it's there. And I prefer the mint pouches.
So if you're 21 or older, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. You can order nicotine pouches online. They ship directly to most states, or check out their store locator to purchase pouches at thousands of retail locations around the country. Black Buffalo Tobacco Alternative, bold flavor, full pouches. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults age 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco. Hey everybody, I'm talking here about Montana Knife Company from our very own state of Montana. This company was founded by one of the most experienced master bladesmiths in the world, Josh Smith, who over recent months I've become friends with. And my God, have I learned a lot about knives from this guy. Just a phenomenal hometown company that makes world-renowned knives. Josh has been making knives for 30 years. You get one of these knives up and open it, it is sharp like something that came from outer space. And here's the deal. They make knives that can be sharpened. You can work on these knives. If you don't want to work on them, you send it to them and they'll work on it. They'll get it sharp. Phenomenal hunting knives. If you want to see them in action, we just did, me and John Hayes, the taxidermist, just did a video about how to properly skin a black bear. Watch that video, and in that video, you'll see Montana Knife Company knives in action. MKC products usually sell out in minutes of being released, which is true. But now, for the first time, they're dabbling with having knives in stock on their site. So right now, you can grab yourself a Blackfoot 2.0 or the Ultralight Speed Goat. Use code MEATEATER, and you get 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company. Working knives for working people. 10% off with the code MEATEATER. That's a good deal. Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? And you probably got rain gear, but you shouldn't overlook sunny day gear. Columbia PFG SolarStream Elite Hoodie has you covered on the sunniest day. Man, I was just in Hawaii and I had my Columbia PFG SolarStream Elite Hoodie with me. And here's the deal. We're in and out of the water all the time, getting in to go spearfishing, getting out, taking the kids to the beach. I'm not going to mess around all day putting sunscreen on, then having to get washed off. I just run a hoodie. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this SolarStream Elite hoodie is built with broad spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50, and it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head on over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all of their performance fishing gear. That particular city that burned, that the story you tell in your book demonstrates a little bit of the of a different perspective on collateral damage than you see in warfare today. Where in warfare today, yeah, there's so much public emphasis on not, you know, targeting civilians where you're hitting.
Yeah.
And you tell in that story that Allied bombers are actually trying to get to a different place entirely.
Yes.
And they can't get over the mountains because of weather, and they just find a town.
Yeah. Sure. And
they don't, find a town and level it.
They want to return to the base empty.
Yeah.
And it was probably the reason why the city of Rosenheim was destroyed in a gigantic conflagration. So, only later, and let me add up one thing with a sky in the distance pulsing in flames. It made me curious, and I knew there was something out I wanted to understand, I wanted to learn. So, and that's why I moved out, and that's why I have been so much around. And it's very strange because people ask me, why can you say that you are a writer? And I have always maintained that my writing will live longer, my prose, my poetry will probably live longer than my films. How do you somehow compare that? Why is there a conflict between filmmaking? No, it is not, and I have a simple, almost like a formula. Films are my voyage, and writing is home.
Oh, yeah. That's your films are your forays out into the world.
Yeah, yeah. Writing is home.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That brings me to a question that I was hoping to share with you, to ask you about. Like I said, I was unfamiliar with the level of poverty that you grew up in.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Oh, no. This isn't children, coming from a place of pity.
No. I don't want to be commiserated for children. It was a wonderful, incredible time. And we had to take responsibility. We had to go out foraging. We were the ones who would catch trout in the creek. But since we had no fishing gear, we caught them by hand. You can catch trout.
Yeah, you explained that, method in your book. It was like slow movement and then a quick grab.
They flee under stones. They take refuge under tufts of grass overhanging into the creek, into the water. And you know where they are hiding. And you have to be very, very patient and cautious. And you actually can catch them with your own hands. People think I'm making it
up. No, but I don't. I don't.
You have probably done it yourself.
Considering that childhood, it made me rethink your film Happy People.
Yes.
And within the last day or two, maybe it was even our producer Corinne, or Phil, the engineer here, I mentioned Happy People, and he said, "You mean the people?" I don't remember who said. They said, "You mean the people that seem miserable but they're happy?" And I wondered about that, or some joke like that. Meaning, I just remember watching Happy People, which is about Siberian hunter gatherers and fur trappers, and just seeing someone carpeted in mosquitoes. I mean, it was like they had apparel, like their apparel was made of mosquitoes, you know?
Yeah.
But just working away. And
without complaint.
Yeah, without complaint. Yeah. And that's what I thought about because in Happy People, there's no person meditates on the meaning of happiness.
No.
No person says, well, in spite of appearances, I'm quite happy. There's no, it's just the title is Happy People, but then it's this portrait of people, and no, a viewer would not watch Happy People. And if someone said, "What did you watch a movie about?" They wouldn't say, "I watched a movie about these very happy people."
Yes, and not only happy, they are dignified. They lead a life full of dignity, of awe, of wonder, of nature, of being out there, a life that has a lot of deep meaning. I envy them. And when I see them on a screen, there's only one wish. Oh, man, I would like to join them.
Oh, yeah. I can see that feeling. Yeah.
And the fact that they do not have, let's say, electricity and air condition and mosquito repellent, and you just name it, just their dogs, their hands, their intelligence, and rifle and fishing gear. And they live an incredible life, so fulfilled, so wonderful. And whoever sees this, and I believe those who actually have ever hunted, they will immediately understand, instantly.
Yeah.
I envy them.
Yeah. I had watched your films, but became interested in your thinking about nature and you're thinking about animals. Like I had seen A Geary Wrath of God, I'd seen Fitzcarraldo, which are great stories, really enjoyable films, and it sparked a curiosity in me about how you view things. But then the Timothy Treadwell incident happened. So just to give listeners a quick run through, Timothy Treadwell, I think he's born in the late 50s, if I'm not mistaken. He had been wanted to be an actor. He had actually was in competition with Woody Harrelson for the...
Well, that's what he claims. We do not know exactly.
So that's not known for sure. Yeah.
We can look at him and say he was a failed actor. And then deeply, deeply into alcohol and drugs. So he was struggling to get out of addiction. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that brought him to Alaska. Because out there in nature and with a task that he put on his own shoulders to protect the bears against the bad guys, the poachers. Mm-hmm. Poachers hardly exist at all, but that was his fiction under which he lived. And he got himself straightened out in a way. And when you look at him, of course, he has moments where he unravels and where he's completely falling apart, but moments of deep insight, moments of poetry, moments of beauty, what he's doing, what he's seeing, how he describes it, how he depicts things. A wonderful, wonderful kind of life out there in the wilderness.
In my world at that time, there was, this is what I was getting at about when I became interested in your in how you viewed these, because in my world at that time, meaning, you know, fairly serious outdoorsman, strong Alaska connections, there was just, people reveled in his death. And it was just how stupid, he should have known, what a nut job. And then I would find myself, before you did your film, I would find myself joking, like, that man would out-camp any person I know. And I would say, I would love to see you go spend 13 summers in an alder thicket on the Alaska Peninsula.
And like, with a go very dense that. Population of grizzly bears.
Go do that and then come tell me how stupid the guy was. You might not agree with what he stood for. You might not agree with his practices, but like, there was a tenacity and a sort of outdoor expertise. And then your film came out and it's like, I had joked about it and commented on it, but your film came out and was so, it was so like open-hearted and fair.
And the respect for him.
But the proper condemnation, the proper respect, but just painted a wholly different picture than what you got from the media, which was this just nothing but a nut job.
Yeah, you know? That was a small part of the media. But of course, it's also unusual that the filmmaker has an ongoing argument with his protagonist, who was already killed by a bear 10 months before.
Mm. Was that and all it was, still, 10 months when you were working on that? So you got to it right away.
Yeah. I never met him. Of course, he was dead when I heard about, and his girlfriend was also killed and eaten by the same bear. So it doesn't matter that I differ from him. And I differ from him in some basic, I say it with caution in quotes, basic philosophy. He was more a little bit towards New Age, which I can't stand, this pseudo-philosophical babble. But behind this New Agey aspect of wild nature, there's something which I call the Disneyization of wild nature. For Treadwell, the bears were wonderful, big-hearted, fluffy creatures, and you had to approach them and, if possible, even hug them and sing a song to them and tell them how much you love them. And one of the native Aleutic people on Kodiak Island, he says on camera, there was something wrong. You do not love the bear. You should rather respect the bear and respect the territory. Keep your distance. Allow the bear its territory, but you do not need to love it. You do not love the bear. Respect it. And that, this kind of philosophy that went awry into Walt Disney fluffiness, somehow, unfortunately cost him his life and the life of his girlfriend and the life of two grizzly bears who were shot by park rangers who found them still feasting on the bodies.
How did you first hear that story and jump into that project?
Well, it was unusual because I do things that come with vehemence at me, and it was one of those cases where something stumbles into me. I was at a producer's place down in the valley, a few miles away from here only where I'm sitting, and he had helped me very generously with finding partners for a film. And I paid him a visit just to thank him, and at the end, we were sitting at a glass table full of messy papers and FedExes and half-eaten lunch salad and so. And when I got up, I got up and I couldn't find my car keys. I swear to God, I was searching for my car keys, not for a movie. So I had placed it on the table. And I look at the car key, and he sees it and thinks I spotted some paper and shoves an article to me. It was one of the first magazine articles about Timothy Treadwell. And he says, read this. We are doing a very interesting project. So I took it and my keys went home. And I was sitting literally here, just at this table next behind you. I was sitting there, and normally I don't read these things. I read it. And you know what? I was instantly back in my car, and I rushed down and I said, this is big. This is so big, I cannot believe it. And I said, how far are you in preparations? Ah, we have to start in 8 days at the latest. There's hardly any time left. We have to travel. And then I asked, who is directing the film? And he said, listen very, very carefully. He said, I'm kind of directing the film. Kind of directing this film. So I sensed he didn't know exactly what he was doing or how to tackle this. And I looked at him and I said, no, I will direct this movie now. I was kind of surprised and shook my hand and said it would be an honor. That's and I made the film.
So, when in that movie...
But it was, you see, what was clear, it this is big. And as a storyteller, as somebody who makes movies and also a writer, I know this is big.
In that, there's the famous scene where you I believe you're at a kitchen table and you put on the headphones and you're able to hear the recording.
Yeah.
There was a camera rolling for 6 months during the attack.
Yeah.
And you hear the recording and your comment does more to convey the horror of what you're hearing than perhaps hearing it would,
I barely comment.
Well, you say no one should listen to this.
Yes.
And never let anyone listen to this.
And my comment is even stronger because a camera is over my shoulder. You see only the back or the side of my head, and the camera is on the woman who owns the tape, who has worked with Treadwell for long, long years. And she tries to read from my face what I'm hearing, how horrible it is. And she starts to cry. She can tell from my face that there's something terrible that I'm hearing.
And she had not heard it.
No, and I said to her, please don't ever listen to it. And I said to her something very stupid, please, you should rather destroy it, which she didn't do. She was smart enough not to do it, but she separated her from the tape and put it in a bank vault. So it's locked away from her. And you see, as a filmmaker, you do not have to put everything out, even though it was there and it would have sensationalized the film. Everybody wanted me to include it into the film, the distributor, the TV network, the production company, everyone said, and I said, I will address the tape because it is known it's out there. But I will make the decision. And after I had heard it, I said, it's not going to be in my film. You have to take me out, but I will resist to be taken out. I'm a formidable opponent. Be careful. I will fight. And this is not going to be in my film. Because there's such a thing as a dignity and the privacy of an individual's death. And you do not publicize it and sensationalize it. Period. So, and they understood. And another example, because I saw the film 2 days ago for the first time in many years, The White Diamond. It's about a jungle airship, some sort of...
No, I've seen that movie, yeah.
Yeah, that maneuvers in the canopies of trees. And nearby...
It's in Guyana, right?
In Guyana, yeah. And there's a waterfall, the Cayetur waterfall, 3 times the height of Niagara Fall. Not as much volume of water, but a formidable waterfall.
I've been to that waterfall.
Oh, you have been? Yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you have seen the swifts. there are swifts that come down.
Underneath and beneath.
Down from the sky. They form vortices, a vortex, and then they shoot down and with this speed that is higher than free fall, they swish behind the waterfall, behind this massive curtain. There's a gap, and they have 1.5 million nests behind there. And I was curious, and we lowered a strong guy in the team, actually also a mountain climber, lowered him on a rope with a camera, and he filmed it. And a few days later, a local tribal leader tells us, you filmed that, yeah, but you know, for us in our culture, there's a secret because they're gigantic snakes and they keep the secrets of our people. They keep the treasures of our hearts, and nobody of us would ever look behind the waterfalls. Huh. And very politely he says, could it be that you just saw it, but you don't publish it? And that very moment I said, it's not going to be published.
Yeah. That little bit of, there's something bigger than filmmaking. There's something bigger that you have to live with than the films that you put out for people to enjoy.
There are bigger things than filmmaking, let's face it.
I want to tell you about an American-made success story and Black Buffalo's award-winning nicotine pouches. Black Buffalo was built by dippers with decades of smokeless tobacco use. Black Buffalo is all about the history and tradition of dip, but they understand the convenience and discretion modern-day consumers are looking for. Black Buffalo's nicotine pouches give you the versatility to consume discreetly, but keep the ritual with flavors dippers love. Mint, straight, and wintergreen, all proudly made right here in the USA. Tell them, Chili.
The reason I like Black Buffalo pouches is, one, they're very discreet. And what I mean by that is I can throw one in and almost forget it's there. And I prefer the mint pouches.
So if you're 21 or older, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. You can order nicotine pouches online. They ship directly to most states, or check out their store locator to purchase pouches at thousands of retail locations around the country. Black Buffalo Tobacco Alternative, bold flavor, full pouches. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults age 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco. Hey everybody, I'm talking here about Montana Knife Company from our very own state of Montana. This company was founded by one of the most experienced master bladesmiths in the world, Josh Smith, who over recent months I've become friends with. And my God, have I learned a lot about knives from this guy. Just a phenomenal hometown company that makes world-renowned knives. Josh has been making knives for 30 years. You get one of these knives up and open it, it is sharp like something that came from outer space. And here's the deal. They make knives that can be sharpened. You can work on these knives. If you don't want to work on them, you send it to them and they'll work on it. They'll get it sharp. Phenomenal hunting knives. If you want to see them in action, we just did, me and John Hayes, the taxidermist, just did a video about how to properly skin a black bear. Watch that video, and in that video, you'll see Montana Knife Company knives in action. MKC products usually sell out in minutes of being released, which is true. But now, for the first time, they're dabbling with having knives in stock on their site. So right now, you can grab yourself a Blackfoot 2.0 or the Ultralight Speed Goat. Use code MEATEATER, and you get 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company. Working knives for working people. 10% off with the code MEATEATER. That's a good deal. Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? And you probably got rain gear, but you shouldn't overlook sunny day gear. Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite Hoodie has you covered on the sunniest day. Man, I was just in Hawaii and I had my Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie with me. And here's the deal. We're in and out of the water all the time, getting in to go spearfishing, getting out, taking the kids to the beach. I'm not going to mess around all day putting sunscreen on, then having to get washed off. I just run a hoodie. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50, and it has airflow, so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head on over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all of their performance fishing gear.
You've done a number. You've done two. You've done three films about people. You've done three films about people who were shot down or survived air crashes.
Yeah.
And land in the jungle. So you did one about a woman, the sole survivor from a air crash.
Yes.
In Peru, was
yes,
it?
Yes, in the jungle of Peru.
Yeah, a plane was struck by lightning. She was buckled into a row of seats.
Yes.
Which maybe acted as a parachute. It's just inexplicable. But she and a number of other passengers fell 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
Hit the forest canopy.
More than 10,000, I think. It came down, but we can only estimate from 5,000 meters altitude, 15, 16,000 feet, and she survived it.
Yes.
And probably it's mysterious. I mean, there was a violent thunderstorm at the eastern slopes of the Andes, and this updraft may even take you higher up into the sky. It could happen. And she was on a window seat, on the three seats. Her mother in the middle seat, an obese Peruvian man, immediately falling asleep, snoring on the aisle seat. And she has fragments of memory that she sailed on, strapped to the row of seats. And she complained. She said, people say I left the plane. No, the plane left me.
She kept says, going, yeah.
And you know, I was always fascinated by her story because I was booked on that very flight.
Yeah.
And a huge chain of coincidences took me out of this. And also something, as she was, had the seat, the empty seats and next to her, it's what we call the maple seed effect. If you have the seed of a maple, you have the seed and then something like a wing, and it spirals.
Yeah, yeah.
It keeps spiraling down to the ground. So that may have saved her. There were actually probably other survivors, because some people were found sitting and leaning against a tree. So they must have crawled there, and it was a very eerie scene when the first rescue people arrived. They had actually given up the search after 10 days or 11 days. It was hopeless because the plane had disintegrated in thousands of fragments and rained down. So there was no impact site that you could spot from the air. And suitcases had opened in midair because it was Christmas Eve day, and there were presents dangling in the jungle trees, and also human intestines as decoration. I mean, it's an eerie, must have been a very, very surreal sight.
But she survives.
She survived because she knew about the jungle. She had grown up with her. She had grown up with her parents at an biological station in the jungle.
And then you,
and she understood what was going on around.
Yeah, and then you did two films about, you did a fictional film and a documentary about an individual, a U.S. airman, I think a yeah. Navy pilot. Yeah. And he was shot down over Laos
yeah.
during the Vietnam War, survives all these just horrific conditions. When he finally gets rescued, the helicopter pilots that rescued him can't tell what he is. They don't know who he is. They find a half-eaten snake in his backpack, and it's this airman that had been missing for
yeah.
I don't know how many
half
months.
Half a year.
And thinking about those, and then thinking about when you were doing the there's a documentary made about you making Fitzcarraldo. I remember you saying, talking about the birds in the jungle. And you said the birds here, I'm paraphrasing, you said the birds here don't sing. They scream in agony. But you've spent a lot of time in the jungle.
Sure, yes.
I mean, how do you feel about the jungle?
Well, jungles, I say it also in some written texts in my book, Conquest of the Useless.
Uh-huh.
And at some point I'm saying I love the jungle, yet against my better knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But you see, you cannot take it completely out of context. When Les Blank was filming me, it was right after we had two plane crashes, two small aircraft that brought provisions and extras to us. We have just had our camp for 800 people in the jungle burned down. We ran into a border war between Peru and Ecuador. And my leading character became so ill that we had to fly him back out to the United States, and his doctors wouldn't allow him to return. Then there was an attack of a tribal group far, far up in the mountains that had suffered from the drought. There was the driest dry season in recorded history, in memory. And they had wandered down with a drying river in search, apparently, of turtle eggs. And they clashed with three people, local people, Machiganga, native tribal people, who had been fishing for us and looking for turtle eggs. And they shot them in the dark of the night, and the man was shot through his throat and had also a deflected arrow at his shin, and a woman shot by three arrows into her body, very close, a cluster of three arrows. And so we had to operate them on the kitchen table. They would have died if he had tried to transport them. And I was with mosquito repellent, spraying away the cloud of mosquitoes, and with the other hand, a torchlight illuminating the operation. And all this happens on a daily basis.
Yeah,
and then Les Blank says, let's speak about the jungle. So,
That was the frame of mind in which you approached that answer, yeah.
And the frame of mind should be mentioned at least. Otherwise, it sounds like a crazy statement. It was a very natural statement.
When I describe that movie to people, I describe it probably the way many people do, where it's the story of a rubber baron trying to move a boat from one drainage to the next, and it's just this impossible task.
A huge steamboat over a mountain.
Yeah, and so what you do in the movie, which sounds funny in this age of special effects and CGI, what the movie does the making of the movie does the exact insane thing that is portrayed as an insane thing. No, in the movie.
No, I do not agree. It's not insane.
Okay.
It is, number one, I knew it was doable and I did it. And it is not insane because it's a big metaphor, somehow dormant in us. So big, like, let's say, Don Quixote tackling with his lance the windmills. It's something described, of course, by Cervantes, and we know, that's somehow in us. It's a metaphor, or Moby Dick, the hunt for the white whale.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. And I knew a ship pulled over a mountain by force of human strength and turnstiles and coiling up ropes, and I would move it over a mountain. It's a big metaphor, not insanity. Because it's deep inside of us, and it has something that I could articulate and others couldn't. But since I articulated, we have a metaphor, one more of the metaphors that are probably dormant in many of us. absolutely not insanity. Clinically sane, so to speak, okay, what I did.
I stand corrected.
And at the time, of course, there was no digital effect. It was done in 1981.
You had to do it. Not
necessarily, because 20th Century Fox at the time wanted to produce a film. However, only with a miniature plastic replica and what they called in a good jungle. And they meant the Botanic Garden in San Diego. And I asked them, gentlemen, what's the bad jungle then? And then it became frosty, and I knew I was alone. And I had to do it alone. I was also the producer of the film. And I don't want to miss this work.
How do you look at, with all the movies you made, 60, over 60 movies, and how many books? You've done a dozen
probably,
books?
No, it's probably 80 movies by now.
And a dozen books or so? Or?
Yeah, and poetry. And I just finished yet another book. You have to take it seriously that I am deeply inside convinced that the written stuff, the prose, the poetry, has a more direct impact. Something, and it's not the events. You see, if you, in my memoirs, if you look after event, yes, of course, there are wild events, but it's a style, it's a prose. That's what makes the book.
Oh, I mean, I don't far be it from me to feel the need to tell you this, but I mean, you're a phenomenal writer. And in reading your book, I had said to Corinne, our producer, I had said I had kind of given up on literary memoirs in exchange for memoirs, autobiographies of people who have a story to tell, right? This book is a combination of those two things.
Yeah.
I mean, this book is of a high literary merit. As a writer, as a person who loves the language, it's of high literary merit, but also does that heavy lifting of telling a story that really ought to be told.
Yeah.
Which is how you came to view the world the way you do and produce the work that you did. But I have two last questions. With all that work, how do you gauge which are your favorites? Like, which are the ones you shouldn't have done? What are you glad you did?
Oh, you can stop right away. Yeah. I love them all.
You do?
I truly love them all, and they're all good. They're all good.
There's no one you wish you could put back in the box?
No, for God's sake, never. Only over my dead body.
Yeah.
I would allow you to put it away and put it back. But you have to be aware that, of course, I'm critical as well. And I see mistakes. Yes, I do see mistakes. And I see how I evolved as a kid who made films, because I made my first film at the age of 19.
You made your first phone call at 17.
That's true. Yes, nobody will believe it. Yes, nobody nowadays believes it. Everybody with their cell phones and applications. So I literally made my first phone call at age 17. Yes, all these films, I see mistakes, mistake here, mistake there, but I accept them. I can live with it. And it's the same way like with a mother. You do not ask the mother, your five children here, which is your favorite? And you know who the favorites are. My favorites are all the children that have the worst defects. Huh. The child that has squint eyes. The child that has a stutter. The child that has a limp. And I would be, as a mother, the lioness to help them, defend them, make them proud, shine as great and wonderful as I can shine.
You mentioned a minute ago, you said over my dead body. Let's move on to your dead body for a minute. What? I have no idea what you'd say to this. What? What do you hope and fear about what's going to happen to you when you die? Like, what do you, are do you entertain an idea?
No, I won't be around anymore. I always said posterity doesn't interest me because I won't be around there anyway. However,
but like, what I mean, do you picture? What is your idea? I don't want to get terribly personal in the way it's uncomfortable. Yeah. What is your idea of an afterlife?
I think it's highly likely that there's no afterlife.
So your posterity, like, you don't care about that, and then it's just...
I won't be around. Yeah. However, I did something which was not in my catalog of behavior and thinking, and my brothers and my wife Lena convinced me. There are 80 films, negatives, mixes, tens of thousands of photos, manuscripts, you just name it, documents. It should be somehow preserved. And I started a non-profit foundation, which is has an oversight of the state of Bavaria, where all the rights of all my films, of everything I have created, went in.
To Bavaria?
Well, because my culture is Bavarian.
I feel like you owe that to America.
No, because you do not see where I come from. English was only my fourth or fifth language.
Yeah.
I mean,
but that's the language you work in, though.
It doesn't matter. It's I would not write a novel like The Twilight World in English. I write it in German, and it's translated. And
your new book was translated.
Sure, yes,
that.
And yeah. Very well. The best translator, arguably, from German into English has done it, Michael Hoffman. It's in German prose.
Yeah, but you have zero problem communicating in English.
Yes, but I do not write poetry in English. You can only do it in your mother tongue. But let me go back to the afterlife. Yes, my work will have afterlife because it's owned now by a foundation, by a non-profit foundation. In other words, if I become impoverished tomorrow, I cannot sell the catalog of my films to Turner Classics, or you just name it, because I do not own them anymore.
You're protecting yourself from yourself.
No, I don't need protection against myself. I understand that, and I was clearly told, sat down at a table by my wife, and she said to me, "You think your films are your property?" Yes, many of them that I produced and wrote and directed, technically, legally, they are my property. But you know what? You really do not own them. The people own it. The people, the audiences out there, they own it. They own the books. They own your prose. They own your poetry. They own your memoirs. So, and I'm completely at ease with that, and let life go on. I won't be around.
Yeah.
And that's totally and absolutely fine, because we are made, and all biological life is made like that. I'm totally at ease.
I lied, because I got one last question for you.
Okay.
I haven't gotten to the end of Every Man for Himself and God Against All, your new memoir. Yeah. Do you, this will be for my kids. Do you, in the end of that book, get into acting in The Mandalorian? Or is that not addressed in the memoir?
I believe I'm addressing it, but briefly.
Yeah.
But the end, it has a very, very strange end that you will never see anywhere in world literature. And it has to do with something the Japanese soldier Hiro Onoda, who fought the Second World War 29 years still after the end of the war in the jungle in the Philippines. And he had survived 111 ambushes and being fired at. And he says to me, because we were discussing time, does present time exist, and is there only past and future? And present time is a fiction, which actually is. And he says, but sometimes you can see the future, because one day a bullet was fired at him and the sun very low, and he sees a bullet coming right at him. And with the sun, it has this orange copper kind of glow, and he knows it will kill him. And he only had time to rotate his body to the side, and it whizzed by his body. And I was writing on my last chapter. I knew it was going to be the last chapter, the absence of images, the absence of the human race on this planet, maybe 200,000 years in the future. And I was typing at a window, it was out there, and all of a sudden I have this sensation a bullet is coming at me, because I saw it, and somehow I sensed something golden and greenish iridescent came shooting towards me. And I look up, but it was not a bullet, it was a hummingbird. Sometimes they shoot straight like that. And I looked at my text, and the moment I had reached, I thought, I shouldn't write any more word. And the text stops in mid-sentence. The book, the entire book, stops in mid-sentence.
And that's it?
That's it.
Did you get a lot of pushback from an editor?
No, they loved it. That's and good. Audiences, those who read it, you will see when you finish reading the memoirs, you will like it, I guess.
All right. So thank you very much for joining us. Check out Werner Herzog.
Thank you for your patience.
Well, check out all of his movies, and especially check out Every Man for Himself and God Against All by Werner Herzog. And then do yourself a favor and watch Happy People.
Yes, they're highly advisable.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've talked about it a lot. We've talked about it. We've promoted it. We've pimped it. It's here. It's finally ready. You can go right now and get it. You can go right now. Go to where you buy all your audiobooks. Go to where you buy your audio originals right now, and you can get it. It's done. You can get it right now. I'm beating the table because you can get it. What can you get? You can get Meat Eaters American History, The Long Hunters, 1761 to 1775. This is the beginning of a big project, and this is just the first one we're doing. The first installment of Meat Eaters American History, where we explain in great, fun, lively, bloody detail chunks of American history. The one we're starting with is the Long Hunters. If you're wondering what a Long Hunter is, Daniel Boone was a Long Hunter. Everybody knows Daniel Boone, like, oh, he's some kind of pioneer or explorer. Well, he was, but he was a Long Hunter. He was a whitetail deerskin hunter. That was his business. That was his craft. That was his trade. The peak of the Long Hunter era, meaning the peak of the whitetail deer hide business, as we're going to explain in this thing, runs from about 1761 to 1775. If 1775 sticks in your head as a year something happened, that's because it's right before 1776. And if you're any kind of American, you know 1776, Declaration of Independence, the Revolutionary War, okay? There's a reason that this era ends then. And this, you will learn this reason and be fascinated by this. Like, why would the Long Hunters, who are hunting whitetail deer skins, having all kinds of adventures and getting killed like flies, why would that all of a sudden end with the American Revolution? You will learn when you get Meat Eaters American History, The Long Hunters, 1761 to 1775. It's an audio original. You can't read this. You can only listen to it. It's narrated by me, Stephen Ranella, my friend Clay Newcomb, and exhaustively researched by Meat Eater Trivia 30-time champion, whatever the hell he is, Dr. Randall Williams. It's out now. Now, this is the definitive telling of the story of the Long Hunters. It's perfect for you if you are a person who understands or wants to understand how backwoods hunting actually happened in the years before the American Revolution, and how market hunters, these are people who hunt for a living, how they actually went about their business of killing, skinning, selling scores or hundreds of deer per season, which, if they were successful, could be more lucrative than farming. Really, being a long hunter, if you got lucky and lived, and you got lucky and had a good hunt, and you got lucky and all your stuff didn't get stolen by Native Americans, or they wouldn't view it as stolen, they would view it as taking their stuff back from you, which you stole from them, was more lucrative than farming, is more lucrative than being a builder, more lucrative than all that. In this, we start out, there's a phenomenal opening to the book, which is going to hook you like a circle hook. But we quickly get into this question. What is a long hunter? Now, like I said, you know the most famous one of all, Daniel Boone. But he was only one of a generation of backwoodsmen who were hunting whitetail deer for the commercial hide market. I was tempted to say one of a generation of Americans, but as we'll get into, the idea of America hadn't taken shape, and the long hunters did not identify as Americans. We talk about that, about some of these long hunters like Daniel Boone becoming these sort of honorary founding fathers, but they were anything but founding fathers of America. These guys participated in hunting expeditions beyond the line of British colonial settlement to supply a booming, as we'll explain, global marketplace for whitetail deer skins. You might expect from the name, they were gone a long time, months or even years at a time on hunting trips, killing hundreds of deer, killing thousands of deer. These adventures include some of the most hair-raising and jaw-dropping stories of wilderness living and deer hunting known to man. In this audio original, you're going to hear about buffalo stampedes, bear attacks, people getting lost, bodies getting found, long journeys, close calls, and the rise and fall of a forgotten trade in the skin of a creature that remains America's favorite big game animal. We've always had market hunters. We continue to have market hunters, okay? Keep this in mind as you go about getting into this story. And we explain all this. You've got market hunters who hunt for whale oil, okay? If you've read Moby Dick, you've read about whale oil market hunters. You've got market hunters who hunted for beaver pelt. So if you're familiar with the exploits of, say, Jim Bridger, he was a market hunter after beaver pelts. You have market hunters who hunted for buffalo hides and buffalo meat. Buffalo Bill Cody, you probably heard of. He was a buffalo meat market hunter. Davy Crockett, market hunter. Generally, black bear meat market hunter. But these guys were from the era when the thing that the market hunters were after, the money to be made, was in deer skins. But our story is not just the story of the rise and fall of trade in this particular animal. These guys were engaged in a risky business. And this chapter of history, this broad story that we tell in this, includes no shortage of life or death adventures. As you'll see, Daniel Boone is one example. He, in this area that we describe, and we describe it as the first Far West, and we'll explain why we call it the first Far West. And as you'll learn, the second Far West is the one you think of when you think of Far West. When you hear Far West, you probably think the American Great Plains, the Rocky Mountains. As we'll explain, that's the second Far West. This is the first Far West, and it was just as harrowing. Boone, Daniel Boone, you heard the name, you probably don't know. He lost two sons. He lost his brother. He lost his brother-in-law, all in the first Far West. And those are some heart-wrenching stories. But even these father-son tragedies were not limited to the Boones. Like, here's a snippet of a story we tell about a long hunter named Henry Skaggs, who witnessed his own son's death as well. This happened in the late 1770s when Skaggs was hunting with about 20 long hunters in what is now Kentucky along the Green River. They're out. They get attacked by Indians. They lose a bunch of their horses. Most of the guys that are with Skaggs turn tail and run. They want to head back to the settlements. But three of them stick it out. It's Henry Skaggs, his son John, and a hunter named Alexander Sinclair. They go over the Cumberland Gap. And if you've heard of the Cumberland Gap, you're going to, at the end of this, when you buy this and listen, you're going to know more about the Cumberland Gap than anybody you've ever met. They go over to Cumberland Gap and begin their hunt, but it's one of the worst winters on record. Hunters that winter were reporting large numbers of deer simply frozen to death near salt licks. And if you're thinking, what the hell is a salt lick? You will know more about salt licks than anybody you've ever met.
when you finish listening to this. So Skaggs keeps hunting it out, right? All of his friends take off and Skaggs hunts it out. And we tell this whole story. His son gets sick. Soon after, that guy, Sinclair, who's with him, heads off to run his trap line, never to be seen again. Henry Skaggs leaves his sick child and goes to try to find the guy. All he can find is a hole in the ice. And he deduces that the guy must have just fallen through the frozen surface of the Green River, drowned, apparently. The river freezes back up. Shortly after that, Skaggs' boy dies. But the ground's so frozen, he can't dig a grave. So he stuffs his boy's body into a hollow log and stoppers up the ends. He then returns to a station camp. If you're like, what in the hell is a station camp? You will learn very well what a station camp is. And then Skaggs, alone now, after losing his partner and his son, spends his whole winter under an overhanging rock near a salt lick and kills whatever animals he can find that approach the lick. And then in the spring, makes his way back to the settlements. This is like nothing compared to other hardships you'll encounter in this story. Some of these stories blow away anything you'll hear of the Rocky Mountains and the mountain men. Here's another one. In May of 1771, this is a story we tell in great detail. Daniel and his brother, Squire Boone, are headed back to the settlements after a long hunt, and they need to stop to shoot some game for meat that they're going to bring home with them. They set up camp, and Squire is just heading out to hunt when he sees a lone figure coming in the distance. He's cautious about it because he doesn't know who it is. But it winds up being a guy named Alexander Neely, who they'd been hunting with and had vanished on a previous long hunt. The guy's all messed up. His clothing's torn. He's starving to death. His arms and legs are all cut up. Neely explains that he had got separated from a group of hunters and tried to shoot his gun, fire off his gun so they could hear him, but he burned up all of his gunpowder. So he had no way of shooting his gun anymore and never found his hunting partners. Tried to make his way back to the settlement with no gun, so he's got no way of obtaining meat, gets hopelessly lost. And then one day, he's resting against a downed tree and a dog shows up. This dog probably belonged to an Indian hunter, and it runs up to greet him. But Neely strangles the dog and roasts it and makes jerky out of it and stores that jerky in a sack made out of the dog's skin. When Squire Boone finds him, he's still got some of this dog jerky in the dog skin bag, and Squire Boone comments how it was quite alive with maggots. This is all stuff you're going to hear about. It's stuff that blows your mind. And I had been, my whole life I've read about the long hunters, and these are all, like, so many of these stories, like that one, for instance, are stories that I had never known until we got into this project. Like, this is the level of detail stuff that we drug out through research to bring out in this project. And there's other stuff that's going to really blow your mind, because you might have heard a lot about Daniel Boone or heard the term long hunters even. But there's stuff you might not know, like even just the intricacy of game laws back then in the first Far West. Meaning there was restrictions on the kind of hunting that these backwoods frontiersmen were supposed to do. Whether or not people listened to them or not, there were restrictions passed by lawmakers to try to discourage these colonial backwoodsmen from engaging in the deerskin trade. So this is an era when Daniel Boone and these other Euro-American hunters are literally having like running gun battles with Native Americans over access to deer herds. Meanwhile, there's people trying to impose game laws on them. There was a law meant to prevent these so-called, quote, disorderly persons from hunting deer, quote, merely for the sake of skins, which lawmakers pointed out were clandestinely carried out of the colony in order that the hunters could avoid paying taxes, or that legislators in some areas had explicitly banned the practice of shooting or killing any deer just for the skin. You could not kill a deer for the skin while leaving the flesh in the woods to rot. If you did, you were subject to a fine. And in this project, as you're listening to this, you'll learn like how that could be reconciled with this history of people who are killing hundreds or thousands of deer for the skins. Likewise, to try to discourage over-harvest by market hunters. In North Carolina, check this out. They had a law that prohibited you from hunting deer if you didn't have a settled habitation in the colony.
So nowadays, when you hear people complaining about out-of-state hunters, there were rules like that in place then, and we lay these out. I think the reason most stories miss this stuff is because they have an audience that isn't going to understand it, or they fear they won't understand it anyways. But our audience understands this, and you're going to be like delighted in these kind of intricacies. You needed to have, in certain places, check this one, you needed to have 5,000 corn hills within the colony in order to be a legal deer hunter. Meaning they would, at that time, they would say like, no, you can't be from out of town. You got to have land. Not only do you got to have land, you have to have 5,000 corn hills. And you'll learn what a corn hill was and why that mattered if you wanted to hunt deer. South Carolina, at the time Boone was out being Boone, South Carolina passed a law that made it illegal to hunt more than 7 miles from one's own home in an effort to try to restrict these commercial deer hunters who would come through an area and wipe out the deer to get the hides. There were exceptions to these rules, meaning they still, even back then, you've heard of depredation permits now, even back then, pre-America, okay, pre-Declaration of Independence, there was exemptions for landowners who needed to kill deer to protect their crops. And there were exceptions for people who needed to kill deer for food, what they called the necessary subsistence of himself or his family. But even then, they had provisions back then. If you killed a deer for food, you were not allowed to sell or dispose of the skin because they were trying to deter these frontier settlers, these crazy backwoods wild men, from hunting deer for skins. These restrictions, combined with declining deer numbers, are part of what pushed the long hunters to go further and further west into the farther reaches of this first far west. Now, what we wanted to do with this book, I'm just giving you a handful of examples of stuff you're going to learn. We're talking, this is hours of material that's like expertly researched and very succinctly presented. This is just me talking about this thing, but this thing is different because it's perfect, okay? What we wanted to do in the book is we wanted to dig into the historical sources so we could tell you who these guys were, like really who they were, where they came from, what their backgrounds were, what their circumstances were, what pushed them into this very deadly, bloody trade, why they engaged in the deerskin trade, which means we have to explain what America was then, who Americans were then, what the globe looked like then, what cattle ranching was like, why there was a shortage of leather. In telling this, we explain all this other stuff. Like, why did they use the rifles they used? When you hear of a Kentucky long rifle, what did that mean back then? Now you shoot it because it seems old and antique-y. They shot them because it was the most sophisticated weapon you could get your hands on. They were shooting state-of-the-art equipment, cutting-edge equipment. Why was that the way it was? How did they camp? Because, I mean, remember, no, they didn't have flashlights. They didn't have lighters. They didn't have tents. But they're gone for 2 years, killing deer in the woods. How did they camp? What did they eat? What were their interactions with Native people? What were the long hunters' interactions with tribes, the Shawnee, the Cherokee, who had a rightful, thousands of years old claim to these hunting grounds? And this becomes a really complicated thing that we'll explain. The long hunters had this idea of this area against all historical evidence outside of these things that they saw when they were there. They had this idea that it was unclaimed. And we're going to talk, we talk a lot about that. Why did the long hunters think there was this landscape, the first far west? Why did they think it was unclaimed? And why did the Shawnee and Cherokee and other tribes know that in fact that was not true? It was quite claimed. They had been hunting it a long time, and they were not going to stand by and watch these Euro-Americans come in and rape and pillage the landscape and deplete it of deer. So we explore this just like very different perceptions of the American wilderness. To the long hunters, it was wilderness. It was the unknown. It was the dark and dangerous, right? To the Shawnee and Cherokee, it was home. It was their hunting spot. And this disagreement takes many shapes and forms, and we dig a lot into this so you can understand this interplay of America
and Native America on the landscape. How did the Longhunters like actually hunt deer? This is something that like that our audience is going to want to know, because you might just read in a normal history book, they hunted deer. But you know about hunting deer, right? You know about bait. You know about blinds. You know what still hunting is. You know what deer drives are. You know what ambush hunting is. We tell you how they were so effective, like how they hunted deer. And a normal history book might be like, they sold the skins. They processed the skins. But you want to know more. We tell you like how they skinned them, what they did with those skins step by step. And we're honest with you when there's parts of that explanation that we don't know, and we tell you why we don't know what we know. We tell you why, how we know what we know, and we're straight with you when we tell you what's not known, how the skins get to market. And then, how did those skins travel across the Atlantic to craftsmen and consumers in Europe? And get this, how did pirates play into this whole thing? It includes a deep dive on the global financial circumstances, the global economic circumstances that drove the deerskin trade at that time. And all of this plays into explaining what would cause a person who could become some humdrum farmer to instead risk fairly certain death, pretty certain death, damn certain trouble and risk to go out and become this thing called a long hunter. Meat Eaters, American History, The Long Hunters, 1761 to 1775, narrated by me, Stephen Ranella, and Clay Newcomb. Available now wherever you get your books. Telling you what, Decked is a game changer. Decked has completely changed how I load, organize my truck. All my stuff that I want is always in there, out of my way, and secure. It's perfect. If you own a pickup truck that you use, you know, like a truck, the Decked drawer system gives you weatherproof storage for all your gear. You can lock it up, too. You keep your tools and gear organized. Job site or out in the field. Go to decked.com/meateater to receive free shipping. Go to decked.com/meateater and get yourself some free shipping. Hey, if you follow wildlife news at all, you're probably aware that the island of Maui has an incredible abundance of axis deer, so much so that they're causing ecological damage. Well, Maui Nui venison is thinning out some of those axis deer herds and delivering venison sticks and fresh cuts to your door. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. Use promo code MeatEater for 20% off your order.